You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew Taylor. I'm Chief Executive here at the RSA. I'm delighted to welcome you to today's lunchtime conversation. It's my great pleasure to welcome a wonderful panel of guest speakers for our debate today. Maria Adebowale, Leah Hollis, Anastasia Knox and Gareth Meir. Leo is a historian, urbanist and author of Cities Are Good For You, The Genius of the Metropolis, and he writes frequently on the politics of place shaping and well-being. Maria is the founding director of Living Space Project, an urban placemaking think tank, green space and consultancy. Gareth is head of research at the Heritage Lottery Fund and oversees the fund's programme evaluation work and the research it undertakes to develop new initiatives. And Anastasia is an associate director of research and insight the agency Britain Thinks, and recently led a project on behalf of HLF and the National Trust. So this is a great panel, and the focus for our conversation today is the findings of the RSA's Heritage Index. The RSA and the Heritage Lottery Fund released last week, a UK-wide Heritage Index that brought together 100 indicators into a single score of heritage vitality. So we're here to talk about that index on what we've learn from it, but there is a broader context too, and that context is that George Osborne confirmed again this week a move towards devolving more power to cities and city regions. And so with this power comes a greater capacity for places to shape themselves, to decide what their economic and social identity is going to be. And the question for us, which really inspired this whole project, was how can heritage in all its many forms, be at the heart of that conversation about place and the future of place. The first piece of work that we did as part of this project, before the index even was developed, we explored heritage in this question of place shaping. And what we identified was what we called an identity gap, that too often when places talked about their future, they didn't think richly about the specific and unique identity of their place and how that would be built into their future strategy. Because once one starts to think about identity, one automatically starts to think about heritage. So in a sense, the fact that heritage isn't always taken seriously as a place-shaping asset is a reflection of the fact that identity isn't always grasped as a key issue in relation to place-shaping. So I think really rich conversations for us to have. And we're changing our format slightly. Each of our speakers could make a speech in their own right. Maybe we'll invite them all to do that at some future stage. But today, I'm going to ask them a series of questions. And then we're going to turn it over to you to join in the conversation with your own questions. So I'm going to start in the most basic place of all. I'm going to start with you, Maria, with asking the question, what does heritage mean to you? And how do you think the concept of heritage is evolving and changing?
Okay, so I think everyone obviously has a personal idea of what heritage is, and so I should tell you a little bit about my bias for why I kind of think heritage is a certain thing. So I'm from a mining town, North Yorkshire, but lived in London and also been on the English Heritage Commission. So for me, I think of heritage as something which is about experience of a place, a sense of place. It's about how you have felt in a place, the physicality of it, the green spaces, the buildings, and the activity that takes form, whether it's between buildings or within buildings. And I think for a lot of people, it's also about the intangible sense of place. So heritage is about something to which you feel connected to. It might be part of your cultural experience or your historical knowledge of a space. And so for me, it's both the intangible and tangible. It's the physicality of something. It's how it makes me feel. But it's also not necessarily always a positive thing. I think of heritage as something in which we also battle over.
Well, what a brilliant answer. The challenge panel is to add anything to that. It seems to me to be kind of, I think that's kind of nailed it really, hasn't it? But Leo, what have you got to add to that?
Well, it's worth, I think, sort of just reminding ourselves of the definition of heritage in the actual report, which I think is a really good one. It's anything inherited from the past that helps us collectively or individually to understand the present and create a better future. I grew up during the Heritage Wars, those kind of sort of slightly dour conversations and arguments that were occurring in the sort of 80s and early 90s, trying to define kind of who owned heritage. It strikes me that still heritage is something of a volatile kind of subject matter. Heritage is obviously different from history. History is a kind of object, but heritage is the story that places that object into some kind of narrative. And it's always going to be volatile as a result of that. Whose narrative is it? Where does it fit in? And what is it really sort of saying as a story? So for me, heritage in some ways sort of gets me to sort of think about whose bees are buzzing where, and whose story is being told in any particular place. I mean, I'm just thinking this week, there was, news from the Conservative conference where they're sort of saying, we're going to get rid of all council estates. Now, that's a heritage question, or is it a heritage question? So that's what heritage means to me.
Did the heritage walls take place in a particular... I love the idea of a plaque saying the heritage walls took place... The first great heritage war took place here. That'd be fantastic.
It would be lovely, yes. Yeah, but...
Okay. Good. So kind of contested... idea and constantly kind of dynamic, and I like the notion that in a sense when one looks at most debates, there is a kind of, they are refracted in some sense in a debate about heritage. Anastasia, over to you.
Well, I think I'm quite like a lot of the people I talk to in the course of my research, actually, and that when you say heritage, the thing that comes to my mind is immediately the built environment. I think of, beautiful buildings, kind of monuments, those kinds of things. But actually, you scratch below the surface and you find all of those things that Maria's talked about. It's all equally important, and all kind of playing together to create a sense of kind of identity, community, place, and a kind of broader experience.
Great. And Gareth, you actually have to specifically have a definition, don't you? Because it's kind of what you can and can't fund. So there is, for you, there is actually a right answer to this question.
No, you don't know about this, but HLF is sort of well known within the heritage sector for not doing that, actually.
Oh, right. Okay.
So,
is it because you just decided it was impossible?
Well, it's because it was an opportunity to sort of see a way of broadening heritage. I think it's been a very important sort of philosophical position which HLF has taken for a long time now, which is to come along and say, well, we're not going to define heritage. We're interested in what... people come to us and say matters to them, what they value as heritage, who it's important to, who values it, why they do, and therefore then what they want to do with it within a project. But, I mean, clearly, by default, we end up defining it slightly by the projects that we fund, and that's, it does stretch across the things that you've been talked about. As it's broad for us, it's historic buildings, it's museums, it's archives, it's historic parks, it's landscape, it's countryside, and it's all of those increasingly, all of those sort of intangible heritage, cultures and memories type things as well. So we do it by default in that way, but I think it's a very important principle for us not to say we've defined it and here's our list of the things which we're going to sort of go down through and tick off in sort of with lottery funding to make sure those are fixed and done properly. I think it's a principle which has stood us in very good stead for the last sort of 10, 15 years. I think it has some sort of issues which we might come on to later. I'm not sure that if you're a heritage activist or somebody involved in local authority planning for a place, not to have some concept of what is the heritage of your place and how is it being used. I think that's probably more difficult, which is one of the reasons for the Heritage Index. But for us, I think it served us rather well.
Let's just explore, panel, that this kind of issue of the relationship between tangible and intangible heritage, the heritage of things and this kind of heritage, which is really around kind of ideas and culture and memories and those kinds of things. So the way you describe it, it's quite rich, this idea that there is these kind of two notions of heritage. But you said also there are maybe kind of problems associated with it. I guess one problem that's associated with it is that the intangible side starts to fringe into the possibility of being almost anything. So how do we handle that? And the danger is that once heritage starts to become almost everything, we lose sight of the fact that it has to also be about very difficult choices about old stuff.
Yeah, yeah, well, the fallback answer, I suppose, is to sort of say that heritage is as much about something we do as a bunch of stuff, something we collectively do as well as a collection of stuff, yeah? And so let's have a continuous social you know, say a social discourse of the RSA, probably, wouldn't you? A conversation about what's taken from the past, used in the present, and into the future. And that's never ending. And it immediately raises questions about, well, whose voice is being heard in that, who's making decisions, how are decisions about heritage being made, and who's taking them, and about power.
And Anastasia, you've got your kind of finger on the pulse of, you know, the great British public. Do you think that this quite complicated notion of intangible heritage is one that people can get their heads around? Or would they prefer that we stuck to kind of castles and parks?
No, I think the intangible heritage is crucial, really. And actually, often, it's the element of heritage that people find tells them the most about themselves and who they are and where they're from. And they really, really value it because of that.
Marie?
I'd agree with that. I mean, I've recently been working on a project with 150 community groups supported by a big lottery, payments, grants, and actually place came up a lot, and actually it was very much around the intangible as well as the old stuff, the bricks and mortar. And I think it's kind of interesting to look at heritage when we have a changing demography as well, and looking at the demographics in different communities about how they see heritage and how it's connected both to the tangible more than the intangible, depending on what the diaspora might be.
And Leah, what is the kind of relationship between this kind of hard and soft notion of heritage? Is it that the soft always, in a sense, relates to the hard, that it's kind of epiphenomenon of the hard stuff, or are they kind of often completely different domains?
I think they can work together. I mean, I think the way that they sort of work is that idea of, you know, heritage is something that explains the present, but also can create that better future. So it's using those things that can actually sort of push through an idea or a place. Placemaking is a very intangible idea. It's about the life between buildings, and it's about so much more than just what's happening within that sort of that space. It involves those stories, and you know, the in many ways, sort of heritage is one of those tools that allows that story to be told.
I suppose the thing about the intangible side is that you can willfully make it, in the sense that, you know, if you live in Milton Keynes, you can't build a medieval castle because there wasn't one there. It's just not open to you to talk about the pre-20th century history of your city. But you can create now notions of identity and place and struggle which are contemporary.
Yes, and as are rich. You know, Milton Keynes has a sort of 30-year history, but its sense of self, its heritage as a story can be as rich as one that spans 2,000 years.
Which takes us neatly into the index itself. And I'm interested, panel, in kind of what you... Is there anyone from Warrington here, by the way? Because we are very, very unpopular in Warrington, and I want to apologise on behalf of the RSA to the city of Warrington, which is, of course, massively rich in all forms of heritage. I say that for those of you who don't know, because Warrington did, unfortunately, come bottom of our index in relation to heritage assets. But apart from the kind of simple ranking, I'll start with you, Gareth. What were the things that came out of that index that were surprising to you, or enlightening?
Yeah, on assets. We're saying this about Warrington because they didn't on heritage activities. They did right. Pretty well. And we were, in a sense, we were a bit surprised. We were wondering which one, because there's always a chance that the journalist was going to go for somewhere at the bottom of the index. And Warrington got it, but we were thinking
surprise,
it was either going to be...
the Daily Mail went for the most gloomy story.
Well, and the Times, was this a sort of northern bias as well amongst the Times journalists? Because they could have gone for a place next to Southend, or they could have gone for Luton, of course, was the other possibility. Right. I thought the most surprising thing for me was, if people are not so familiar with it, what we did was to construct an assets index, so the stuff in a place, and an activities index, so the extent to which heritage was being used, if you like. So that had things in it like participation, investment, lots of things to do with sort of social activity, from heritage open days, blue plaques, extensive neighbourhood planning. All of this sort of stuff was going in the activity index. My guess at the beginning was that we would find a pretty strong relationship between those two. I thought the chances are that the places with lots of stuff would actually have probably, you know, a lot going on as well. There was a bit of a relationship, but it was nowhere near as strong as I was anticipating beforehand. So you basically got the sort of, three sets of places. Those which are sort of in line, they've got lots of heritage, lots going on, not much going on. You've got a second tier where they've got even more on the end, and there were lots more activity than you might anticipate from the extent of the assets that they had. Fantastic. Shows that, you know, assets are not a limitation on heritage activity. And then you've got, for us, quite an interesting third tier, which is places which are, you think, there ought to be rather more going on in these places than there really is. And that's really revealing, because we've never... I mean, we couldn't have done this. We couldn't have had this as a fund 20 years ago. The mapping and the software wasn't there to do that, and a lot of the data wasn't there either. But for us to have that as an insight, I think, is tremendously powerful, and we'll spend some considerable time looking at it and the implications of it, I'm sure.
Leah, what did you... What was your kind of take out from it?
In my area, which is sort of cities, there is an infinity of rankings of cities, whether you rank them by livability or ease of starting up businesses or everything like that. And
is
I don't think
ranking
that
of rankings? Is there a kind of
there
ranking?
Is, there should be a ranking of rankings, because they're all rather ridiculous. I can understand why one would index. I find it quite a difficult thing to sort of see what the actual results of it are. You know, how do you really compare like with like? Because you're not really doing that. You're trying to sort of make a competition out of things that don't necessarily compete, unless they're competing for money. And one of the driving sort of forces behind this report, I think, is the economic. And I think that's perfectly fine. But that seems to be the plane on which quite a lot of this sort of index is based upon, when actually what's really interesting is looking at the kind of sort of relationships and the balances between the assets and the activities. And I think that's where things are really interesting, particularly when you look at the sort of basic sort of rudiments of placemaking, which the importance of assets and activities coming together and working together.
So, Maria, that kind of question that Leo... I mean, obviously Leo is basically saying that he didn't really like it at all, so I don't know. I don't really know why we invited him, to be honest. I'll be taking it up with the events team later. But... Maria, this issue that Leo's raised, this kind of, and Gareth as well, this relationship between assets and participation. I wonder whether you've got a perspective. Why is that? Is that kind of random, or is it to do with the fact that there are, you know, activists like you who operate in a place and simply grow a kind of capacity, how would you account for this greater difference than Gareth expected between heritage assets and heritage participation?
I mean, I agree with Leo, so maybe you're going to boot me off the panel as well. But I think the index is really interesting, partially because it brings the data together, hasn't been done before. So I do think we need that. I think the one thing that's very difficult as a researcher is actually understanding capacity within a community and participation and what the models have been for people to participate around heritage. So, I mean, one of the surprising things for me was Tower Hamlets. Lots of museums, loads of archaeological digs, etc., etc., and yet it's 10% as far as visits to museums go, 10% lower than the national average. Now, why is that? And actually, I think an index like that needs to unpack it. You know, is it because actually what we're doing in preserving heritage isn't very good? Sorry, Tower Hamlets. Maybe the museums don't actually reflect the communities and the people and the heritage, which is very rich there in those areas. Maybe it's because of the cuts to the local authority budgets, which are massive to non-statutory duties at the moment. So, you know, the list goes on. I just think we need to unpack this idea about capacity building. I've never worked in a community, myself or my colleagues, and had a community say we're not interested in heritage, whatever that might be, whether it's, you know, as we said, buildings or between spaces. So I do think that the index is missing something on trying to understand the capacity building. There's lots of activism and there's lots of interest, and people get very passionate about heritage, you know, in all the different ways that they define it. And an index like this, whether you did it, or I would say, or any other, you will have difficulties in trying to work out why we got to where we got to in relation to who's taking part in the decision-making around heritage. That's a really big part of this. We need to unpack that more.
Absolutely. And I wouldn't want to be defensive about the index, although I am going to be defensive about the index. But, I mean, I said two things. First is it's a first iteration. And I think one of the things is we will learn from it, if we do it again, about what we didn't include that we should have included, or what we gave too much weight to, what somewhat gave too little weight to. So we see it as kind of something that, not a kind of technocratic tool for judgment, but actually something which enhances people's kind of conversation about what an asset is and what participation is. So I think, and also, you know, as that implies, what's interesting is that Warrington come out bottom, and what's happened in Warrington is there's been a huge flourishing of conversation about this, which is precisely what we wanted to do. So it's not a fixed position.
And that's good. And that's why I'd like to see this done more regularly. I'd like to see the change, and whether or not the index has made a difference, or whether there's new things, new indicators we need to be looking at. So I think you're absolutely right. It's a point in time. Let's look on further on.
So you're basically saying to Gareth that you think HLF should continue to fund this work out the RSA.
Yeah, I mean,
just so we could note that for the record. Anastasia, Anastasia, more broadly, because you've looked at heritage and through the kind of lens of thinking about what Britain thinks, that's the title of your organisation, tell us about the kind of class and ethnicity dimension to this question of heritage. You know, I suppose the kind of lazy assumption would be that older white middle class people spend all their time visiting castles and stuff like this, but if you're talking about young black men, then heritage would have not, you know, but that's obviously lazy. But I'm interested in, what does your research tell you about people's relationship to heritage?
So I think we definitely see a participation gap. So in general, people from kind of lower socioeconomic groups and people from ethnic minorities tend to engage less with heritage, and obviously there's a really big questions to be asked about why that is and how you close that gap. And certainly we do also see areas where that gap narrows. So for example, in some work we did with HLF, we found that actually people from kind of lower socioeconomic groups are more likely to go to parks, for example, than people from other groups. So it's about understanding why that is and how we can address that more broadly. I think really importantly, we also see that actually when the kind of less, those who engage historically less with heritage do engage with it and they do take part, it can have a much bigger impact actually than for the kind of traditional white middle class audience. It can really tell them something very important about who they are, about the culture they live in and society more broadly. So it can have a very large impact.
I mean, this is an obvious question, but is this issue about how it is you define heritage? So if you were to say to a young man, for example, music is full of heritage, and the people whose music you listen to are reflecting a heritage of music, would that change their view of whether or not they were heritage participants? Is it that they think it's about castles?
Yeah, I think I'm sure that is a part of it, having kind of traditional notions of it. I also think it's about having heritage that actually reflects, or heritage activities that reflect their sense of who they are. So, for example, we did a workshop some time ago in Bradford, and we had lots of British Asian participants, and they were talking about the heritage in the local area, and some of them said, well, you know, it just doesn't say anything to me about my family or where I'm from. So it's not interesting to me. I'd much rather see something that plays back a story I recognise.
Great. I spoke to Charlie Leadbeater a while ago about some work he'd done on low-income Londoners. We were just chatting about the kind of phrases that people use. And what was very interesting was that he said that the phrase that people use about the fact that they are worried about immigration and diversity has changed. That the phrase people used to use was, I'm not racist, but... And then they would follow that with, you know, I'm worried about immigration and diversity. He said people don't use that phrase anymore because they kind of realise that that has become code for I might be racist. What they've changed it to is there's been a lot of change around here. So that's the phrase that people use. And by the way, that's not a phrase that's just used by white people. It's a phrase used by anybody who's lived in an area for a while who's worried about the kind of... So the reason I say that is because I wonder whether that is connected to what we've found, which is this ambivalence about the notion of identity, that the notion of identity and place is a somewhat dangerous idea because it kind of gives rise to a sense of, well, we had something that was our identity, but now all this change has thrown it up in the air. And so therefore it might be a kind of slightly nostalgic, slightly kind of reactionary idea. How can we kind of, is that true? And how can we have a conversation about identity that doesn't take us into that kind of nostalgia trap? I know it's a big and also rather long question. Leo.
It's a very big question. I think we tend to, despite the sort of the increased narratives of openness that we have, and the idea of social media being open, of the internet giving us access to, you know, the world, the fact that infrastructure allows us to go anywhere we want. We actually sort of spend quite a lot of our time in quite small areas and with small groups of people. And I think it's the consciousness of the difference between what is the possibilities of openness or open city and the actual sort of spaces that we live and spend most of our time can sometimes be quite frightening. Often one gets most frightened about the thing which is just slightly beyond the horizon rather than the thing that is on your front doorstep. And so it's often making oneself or finding mechanisms in which to realise that how we move around places, how we engage with other people is changing, but it's not changing in such a way that, that we're losing our sense of self. I think that's in some ways the sort of really scary thing is we often think that being in a crowd, we lose something of ourselves, when actually we should be able to think of being in that place makes us more of ourselves. Now, that how does that sort of fit in with heritage, I think, is quite a difficult thing, because that's about engaging with the place, but also the narrative of that place. And how do they do that? How do they get the people to come together and to meet in a public space or a museum or even just at a sort of you know, a musical concert or something like that? I don't think there are any easy answers to that. I mean, in terms of sort of cities, I think it goes to the question of trying to create places of trust, trying to look at questions of inequality. So heritage is just only one part of a much larger conversation of what makes an open city.
Maria, the great sociologist Stuart Hall used to make the distinction between nationalism for and nationalism against. So nationalism for was a notion of national identity that invited people in, and nationalism against was the notion of identity which was about defining people out. How do we make identity for rather than identity against, and what is the role of heritage in that?
I think the role of heritage is basically allowing for this notion of flux about who we are. I think we have this idea of heritage that, you know, it's the one thing that, as an individual or, you know, a human race, we are part of one thing. We can only be one nationality, one race, one community, etc. And I think that actually things are changing in the way people identify themselves. We talk about communities. That's a nice kind of fluffy sound for what does that really mean? And actually we all connect to various communities along political lines, etc. And I think heritage has a really important role to play in that it should allow for that. So we talked about some of the visits, you know, who visits what and when and possibly why. And I think some of those visits, you know, who goes to which museums, which parks, etc., are about whether or not people feel their history is celebrated in those areas or connected. There's a big thing about safety in this, well, that's not just heritage, this is about safe cities, open cities as well. People's experience there, whether they feel like other, made to feel like other or otherwise, you know, whether you're female, white or black, etc. So I think heritage has a role in celebrating diversity, not only in bricks and buildings, but also in the human beings that, you know, enjoy these spaces and places. And I think HLF are exactly right, actually, not to define heritage for us, though that can make it difficult. But I think, actually, that's the adult approach to it.
Anastasia, what can you tell us about this question of identity more broadly in the sense of how people are identifying themselves in modern Britain? So, for example, one sense I've always had is that people find diversity easier at a city level. The debate about Britain feels like it's a kind of asking people to choose between are they British or are they, you know, Muslim, or are they British or are they Catholic or whatever, whereas at the city level it feels less problematic. I go to Birmingham, people can be all different types of Brummie, and it's not kind of problematic in the same way. What does your work tell you about people's senses of identity?
You're right in one sense, in that I think it's in some way, somewhere like London, you know, celebrating diversity is part of you know, the brand of London, and it's a really big part of what's kind of talked about and what makes it engaging and a fun place to be. I think the idea that we all have multiple identities is one that would be quite familiar, though, to people up and down the country. You know, you see people, you know, you go to Armagh, for example. I've done some work in Armagh, and people talk about their identity from a religious point of view. They talk about their identity as someone in Northern Ireland. They talk about their identity in a European context. I mean, I think people are quite comfortable with this idea, actually, that they're fluid, that identities can be fluid, and it's about finding a way to maybe kind of celebrate those newer identities that are coming in that might be slightly more challenging for whatever reason.
And Gareth, when HLF looks at kind of bids that people make for investment in heritage, to what extent are you looking for those bids to reflect a kind of richer account of notions of place and identity, rather than simply, here's a building, we want to preserve it?
Well, it depends on the nature of the application, doesn't it? Really, in the nature of the project. But, I mean, I suppose what we're doing is always, I guess in a sense what your question is getting at, heritage can be quite a dangerous thing, can't it? Yeah, I mean, we've got this sort of a handle with care thing there about it being put to sort of positive use. And I suppose what we developed is some golden rules around that, which is that sort of like sense of involvement of people in the design and the where the project has come from in the first place. Always, always, always having an idea of life around heritage. You know, there's just if you go right back to the beginning of HLF, was developed as this sort of the sense of activity and happening around heritage. And that's, you know, nobody gets a project for just doing capital work, and hasn't done for a very long time from HLF. Building life around heritage is absolutely sort of a key as a way of sort of having that conversation about it as well. And the other thing is, I think I'm agreeing with other panellists on this one, is just the opportunities that having lots of heritage activity around in a place creates for this notion of multiple identity. And the more of that you've got, the more chance you've got for finding ways that people are connecting to place and to each other. I mean, in surprising ways, finding they got connections to people which they didn't really know they had before.
And it's true. I mean, I think just to sort of finish,
there's one of the piece of work that Anastasia Britain Things did for us. We had most of the questions were about our investment and about people's feelings about heritage and knowledge of heritage in their area. But there was a question about whether people felt that things in general had got better or not. How people felt about change, and it was really dramatic. I mean, the proportion of people that said that they felt, I don't think we really put a time period on it. We said in your residence in this area, where the things had got better, and it was, any guesses? It was 42%. I think said good things were better, you know, than over this period that they were reflecting on. Which was staggering, frankly.
Mm. Leo, just to ask you this question about very briefly, but there is a kind of sense that one hears of people saying, well, all cities look the same, the city centre's the same, it's the same shops, it's that kind of copycat kind of thing, identikit cities. And that is a comment, that people do want their place to be different, and that should be an opening for heritage. Where do you see that debate? One of the things we have found is that city leaders, they kind of recognise that, they want to be different, but in the end, their plans look pretty similar one to the other, you know.
Yeah, I think that's very true, and it takes a strong takes a strong local authority to be able to control, for example, the high street on a very simple level. You know, as it happens, most out of town shopping centres now moving onto the high street because that's where people are spending more of their time than they were previously, and so the high street is becoming this, firstly, a place which is in some places emptying out, and in other places becoming places of Tesco Metro and these sort of identikit kind of retail areas. And it's to do with controlling rates, but local authorities, or, you know, the people who own that land, it's working on a coordinated basis of being determined of creating sort of spaces of that are unique or local, or, you know, one of the things that I'm sort of very keen on is not just, you know, if our high streets are under threat, they don't just have to be place of retail. You know, you should be able to put other things in there, whether that's a creche or a older people's sort of meeting area, or, you know, it can't just be estate agents and cafes. But that takes kind of bold leadership, and it takes a sort of fairly firm hand over a long amount of time to create that kind of sort of space. And often it's about filling those shops as quickly as possible and getting the rates as quickly as possible.
Final question, panel. It's a hard one, so I'm going to start with Gareth. Just give us an example of a great heritage project. I mean, we know it seems to be there's a kind of a lot of agreement on the panel about we want a living idea of heritage, we want a diverse idea, an inclusive idea of heritage, a dynamic kind of notion. So Gareth, you look at lots and lots of bids and projects. Give us an example of something which you think lives up to that vision.
I'm going to single out one heritage HLF funded project. You know what? I'm not going to do that. I'll think about a heritage asset, something which means to me. So I'd say something like the... this hasn't had funding from HLF. So you take something like the swimming club in the Serpentine in Hyde Park, for example. You've got something like that, which has got a combination of... urban park, collection of people, fantastic history going back over 150 years, which is sort of like continue, has that intangible aspect to it, and a sort of a community around that.
Bit of English eccentricity
to it. And some stories which are just getting passed down all the time through, because, you know, you've got a trophy which is sort of like kept in the tradition of the club for each year, and that person's story gets told one year after another. So I picked that because I don't want to just have a single HLF project.
Nice story. I like it. Maria, give us your favourite example.
I've been thinking about this quite a time and I'm still thinking about it. So I guess I would choose possibly a local project near Lewisham, which is where I live, which is in Manor Park, near Blackheath, and that has recently, well, not so recently, but got heritage funding. But what I like about the manor is that it's been made into a really quite fantastic library. It's opened up as well for various groups to meet. It has a film club. It's right in the middle of a park, which has a green flag. So it's kind of triangulating all the things that make a place livable and lovable. But also it's connected to not just the good fluffy stuff about how nice the house looked, but some of the history around it. Actually, one of the reasons why that house was there was due to slavery, but it actually talks about that story as well. And I think what I like about the project is it's about the now and the present, but it doesn't forget its past.
Great. Leah?
I'm not too sure if it's a heritage project, but I'm thinking of... thinking of being in Sheffield, and which I think is sort of a really interesting city to watch at the moment. I think it's a city that's sort of working out its identity in a very interesting way, particularly sort of understanding that it no longer is that sort of industrial sort of centre, but it probably will sort of see a future as a kind of university town, and so students are becoming increasingly more important. So they have changed the way that you walk from the station into the city that goes past sort of universities. It incorporates historical buildings, but it also creates this public space that sort of weaves up the hill from the station. And I think that's very clever in the way that it's not just relying solely on heritage, it's combining heritage with other really sort of modern buildings as well as modern spaces. Places that, you know, hopefully, you know, students will want to be in when it's not cold and wet. But it's that way of sort of creating a sort of space, using what you have, but also finding other ways of managing it.
Great. Heritage fusion. And it says you're not really from the heritage sector as such, so it's a bit of a harder question for you. You could just tell us what your favourite place is.
So I think maybe I'll tell you about one of the projects that struck the heritage projects that struck me most in the work we did for HLF. So in that work, we kind of identified two ways in which heritage can benefit or bring benefits to local communities. And the first was about a transactional benefit, so creating a fun place to go to kind of entertain the kids, generating tourism money for the local area. And the second benefit was emotional. It's about heritage that celebrates aspect of local culture and which tells residents something personal about themselves. And of course, most heritage does a bit of both. And the project, I think, that struck me most in the course of that research was Big Pit in Pontypool, where residents really saw those transactional benefits and they really valued them. But actually, everyone we spoke to had a relative, knew someone who'd been down the mines, and they felt that actually Pontypool, after Big Pit, was keeping alive that heritage and saying something really important about the history of the area. And the synergy of those two aspects just worked really well there and was really valued.
Great, fantastic examples. So, over to you. What I'm interested in doing, I think you're taking some questions and some points around the room and then bringing the panel back. Let's try and do that a couple of times. So, I've got two gentlemen here.
Hi, I'm Joshua Williams. I'm from Wales, so my grandfather was a miner, but I also work in textiles, so I've got that connection with Yorkshire. And I'm interested to know your thoughts on when is some history or heritage that's somewhat had negative repercussions, how it can be turned around into a positive example, like with the Big Pit example. Are there examples within the textiles in North Yorkshire as well?
Hello, yeah, I'm Chris Dixon from Ashford Borough Council, and Ashford has been going through a significant amount of growth through its people and through its infrastructure. That's been really interesting to see, but I overheard a really interesting discussion the other day about a heritage trail for Ashford and whether we should include something that we have done, which is not Identikit, which is the Ashford Shared Space, which has been 8 years in its lifespan, has been incredibly problematic, but has been really interesting in terms of that push and pull discussion, which has brought out a story and an angst and a positivity within Ashford. I come from an arts background and heritage is coming more towards me, and I would like to ask a question probably more of Gareth in terms of artist's role in heritage and its support to heritage and how that doesn't tread on Arts Council toes from an HLF point of view.
Oh, interesting question. The lady here.
Patricia Lovett. I'm a professional scribe and an illuminator, and I'm vice chair of the Heritage Crafts Association. It won't surprise you, therefore, that I'm going to focus on intangible cultural heritage, specifically craft. I was interested in what Leo said about Sheffield. Sheffield has a cultural plan that doesn't mention stainless steel or cutlery. In Sheffield, there is the last scissor maker, handmade scissors. All of them working on scissors are in their 70s, including Eric, the putter-togetherer. Trevor Ablett was one of the last folding pocket knife makers, and he finished on August the 16th. He shut up his workshop because there was no one he could pass his skills on to, and he was ill. There is no support for intangible cultural heritage as far as heritage crafts are concerned. The government don't understand the significance of being self-employed and being a craftsperson. 10,000 hours to learn a craft, the craft so long to learn, as Geoffrey Chaucer said. We spent a lot of time with government ministers, various government ministers, civil servants, trying to explain this to them, and they don't. Is there any way in which we could ensure our terrifically rich cultural heritage craft past, which is very vibrant now in the future, in the present, goes on to the future because the ageing population have no means of passing on their craft skills?
Hello, I'm Jill Hopper. I'm a writer. I wanted to ask about how community groups can demonstrate the value of their open space when there's not necessarily a financial dimension to it. We've got a fantastic local park near us, and it's becoming a sort of renter space, because in times of austerity, the council sees it as an asset that can be rented out for commercial events. And we find, as local people, that we're fighting to keep it as a free open space. So I'd be interested to hear your views on that.
Tell me about it. I live near Clapham Common, which seems to become a kind of festival site rather than a common. Being controversial there.
I'm Joanna. I'm taking questions from Twitter. Two quick ones. One is the women's contribution overlooked in famous heritage and history? And when decisions are taken to close heritage places, the example here is Bromley Museum, how can these places move on in the future?
Very good. All right, panel. There's an amazing set of questions. How do we turn the negative positive? What's the relationship between arts and heritage? The importance of crafts? How do we keep open spaces when councils are under pressure to maximise the income from them? Are we under we're not understanding women's contribution sufficiently? And what can we do when we simply can't keep somewhere going? Do we just let it kind of crumble and die? What can we do? Okay, very hard, I know, but pick a couple of those, Leo.
I think one of the themes that came out of that question is the fact that heritage is a market, and it often has to sort of prove itself within the market as well. And as a result, those two things don't necessarily always go together. I think it's very difficult in terms of, you know, answering the sort of craft question. How do you take craft and sort of find a sort of shared space in which it could be allowed to be passed on and allowed to sort of thrive or be nurtured? With public spaces, I think it's sort of slightly easier. Is that often space is seen as a valuable resource and one which is becoming increasingly scarce. When actually we should sort of start remembering that those common spaces are in fact common wealth, and it's making that clear. Making something a commons or making something or reminding people that it is a commonwealth comes about from usage more often than not. The best way to sort of show that the park is owned commonly is by using it as much as possible. So that's one way of doing it. But yes, I think it is always, heritage is always going to be rubbing up against the fact that it is, a Venn diagram which cuts into the market in a very strong way, and that is going to continue, I think.
Gareth, one of the things we found, of course, in our work was that there was a relationship between heritage and well-being, which didn't seem to be explained. I mean, we looked at whether or not it could be explained by other more obvious variables, but there really did seem to be a relationship between heritage participation and well-being that was to do with heritage participation. So do you think, in relation to that question, and do pick a couple of other ones, that we should need to kind of strengthen the kind of instrumental argument for heritage, the externalities that it generates, as well as people's appreciation of it?
Yes, and it reflected the finding which we got in the work which Anastasia did for us as well. So you've got anybody's looking to use it, you've got a couple of new sources of evidence to put together there. I mean, I suppose that's sort of the Bromley example a little bit. The making the case, the financial model, I suppose, is what all of this is getting at. What is this ever elusive search for new business models, which engages all of us in difficult circumstances sometimes. I mean, this has all been said before, but the one thing is clearly for places to have an income stream which is going to be coming from public sources of funding, you're going to have to look outside of those the pots of money where that has come from traditionally, so from cultural budgets. We're going to have to make more connections, and people are already doing this, I know, between across to economic development, but also health and social service budgets, to sort of see what the connections and what other non-heritage organisations you can link up with in order to, for them to meet the objectives they want to achieve, which could be social objectives, through heritage. I think there's signs of more of that sort of thing happening. Then, of course, the other thing, which is very easy for our funder to talk about, and I do know from other experience how difficult this is, but there's that sort of panoply of what we just put together in one pot and call non-grant funding. But it is a growing area, and we just got to keep sort of playing on with investigating how heritage organisations can find out about and make more use of social investment and crowdfunding and to some extent sort of like new drivers of commercial income, getting people to come and spend money with you rather than going down the high street and spending it.
Can I just ask you to reflect on one other question, again, although briefly, which is this, link this question about arts and heritage and the point about craft, in the sense that do you think there are things that kind of fall between the cracks of our institutional structure that don't quite get the attention that they ought? I mean, is craft an example of that? That it's kind of, is it art or is it heritage or is it even enterprise, for example?
On the other hand, you could say you've got two sources of where to go to.
These are viable businesses.
The connection I was going to make was between your question and the one about turning negative heritage into positive, because that seemed to be about sort of an economic decline story as well. I mean, is this pie in the sky? Is there a possibility? Is there an opportunity in this whole move towards decentralisation, devolution, that that will force a little bit more of sort of introspective thinking about what were our strengths? I mean, what sort of model of economic development a place is going to go for here? And I know this is contested and that it's not proven in any way at all, but you can do this sort of the passes in another country. You just got to find out what's going to work in a global economy and go for it, and everybody does the same, and whoever does that most successfully wins. Or do you do something which is far more looking back, what was our industrial, what was our city built on, what was our place built on in economic terms, because it would have grown out of that. What still exists of that before it's gone completely, yeah? Both in terms of the assets we've got and the people and the skills that we've got. Is there actually some sort of modern incarnation of all of that which is becoming more relevant and more viable in the future? I mean, I would love to think so. That's what we sort of have to push on. And if there's... There is a sort of a theoretical model around that which has been around for a long time, and a sort of doyen of the heritage movement is Jane Jacobs, mainly for her work on urbanism, but she did another book which I would say every Devo leader should read about cities in the wealth of nations, and that was sort of built on gradually places developing by having import substitution and turning that into export. But you didn't import your export strategy as a place. You went back and always were building on what you'd achieved and done in the past. So that would be a fantastic way for places to move forward under a Devo model, to my mind.
Great, thank you. Anastasia?
So I was quite interested in this idea of kind of turning a negative history into something kind of more positive to take forward. And I think, you know, you can see some really great examples of that. So again, to return to Armagh, there are examples of kind of local kind of community-driven oral history projects that are kind of aiming to heal the divisions in the communities there. And I think one of the key things that's really important in projects like that, or indeed in something like Big Pit, is this kind of idea of honesty and kind of really facing up to the past and talking about it very frankly, and then finding a way forward together, or coming up with a picture or a story that actually everyone involved can see some truth in and they can buy into and that they can accept as a narrative and a way forward. And I think, you know, we have certainly in our research we've seen some really great examples of that happening up and down the country.
Okay. Maria?
I think I pick up the question around parks. I mean, there is lots of research, isn't there, about green space has been really important for well-being. 9 out of 10 people saying that they think parks are really important. Recent research showing that actually if you live near a park, it has a better benefit than a high income, etc. But we are in a time of austerity, apparently, depending on what your politics are, but we're certainly facing cuts. And so I do think heritage around space is, in a way, quite positive in that we can create collaborations that we didn't used to have. I think community groups actually are absolutely crucial for keeping green spaces and keeping spaces public. But I do think we're having to think about what are the alternatives, because otherwise what does happen, I think, is that they do become almost private property, whereby, you know, you're not allowed in it if there's a concert going on. I went to New York recently, and that seems to be one of the main sort of economic streams for Central Park and other parks as well. And it might be we have to look at that, but then it's who's making decisions about the when and the where and where the money goes to. Does it go to the park? Does it mean then that actually local communities can use it for 3/4 of the year? I just think that community groups and local authorities and just the wider society need to think about how parks actually build the future strategy, because, you know, 86% of park managers have seen their budgets cut. 90% again of local budgets are going to hit parks. So I think communities need to think about what collaborative model can we put together whereby we're on the table making decisions, and why not partially own it? We just have to think differently, and it's a little uncomfortable because, yeah, quite rightly, we think parks are as public, but we're going to have to change how that develops, and we're going to have to come up with the ideas, because I think a lot of local authorities are stuck and they don't know where to go with it.
I'm a councillor in Lambeth, and I was responsible for arts, culture and heritage, so I'm the person Matthew can blame for the events in Clapham Common. My point to the panel is, given the crisis in funding arts, culture, parks, libraries, heritage, both in terms of revenue, acquisitions of new exhibits, Is it time to consider a precept on the council tax for arts and heritage? I pay a precept in London for the police and for the fire service, and to me that would be a lot better than seeing parks used for events that people don't want, and it would provide a sustainability for lots of community projects.
Okay, great idea. Yeah,
Derek McCauley, I'm a fellow. This is directed at you, Matthew.
Oh.
How will this work influence RSA? We look at the place we're in.
Very good.
Thanks. Another fellow of the RSA, but also a member of the Nautical Archaeology Society. How is the index being addressed maritime or underwater cultural heritage?
Gareth. Oh, I just panicked. I thought, no, it's all right, Gareth. And then there's the gentleman right down at the front. And then that's it. Phew.
Thank you. I'm Gary Brown. I'm a fellow working a project similar to the Big Pit in North Wales, celebrating the industrial heritage of iron and steel in Brumbo. I'm interested in the index and disagree slightly with Leo's point earlier on, but I see a huge value to the index, and it's a great starting point.
You can come back.
We'll
have you on the panel next time.
As somebody who's in the County Borough of Wrexham, that comes in the sixth out of seven groupings, if you like, for both the assets and for the participation. I'm interested in to what extent you're hoping to use this to drive funding priorities and so on. And I'm drawing an inference, and I'm hoping that I'm drawing the right inference, that if you've got lots of potential to grow heritage and participation, then you're going to be looked more favourably upon in terms of funding decisions. So I'd like to challenge that.
We did spot, before we did the index, that this would give people good leverage for making the case for their particular place, which you have done well. So let's go along the panel. You can respond to any of those points, or you can make any killer point you want in your remaining 30 seconds, and I will say something about the index and the RSA at the end. So let's start. Let's go the opposite direction. Maria?
Yeah, I think you're right about precept tax. I think it's been suggested by a couple of think tanks about whether that's the way we need to go. I think one of the things that might be problematic with that is whether or not that raises taxes and the impact it might have on low-income households. And in the US as well, that's a conversation in some federal states, and it's, well, some people might be paying taxes for spaces that they don't use. So then there's another debate about, well, why don't you use it? But also, actually, maybe they're right. But I do think that might be the way forward. I'm still looking at it. And the second thing was about craft and textiles, actually. Again, another visit to Detroit. I've been around recently. You know, that's an area, a city that's having massive problems. But one of the things it's doing is using craft and art to bring small-scale enterprise back into cities. And people are visiting Detroit because of that. You know, they're retraining on using the fine skills that people have who have been taken out of the motor industry because that's died in Detroit, and using those skills to actually look at things like watchmaking, making bikes. I know this is small scale, it's not going to answer a massive big problem, but I do think crafts, art and textiles are actually part of an economic design for a future of an area, and so heritage there is crucial.
Great. Anastasia?
I think the council tax question is a really interesting one. I suppose there's a question mark for me over kind of how great the kind of wider public appetite for that would be and how that would go down. I also would like to return really briefly to this idea of heritage and well-being. As Gareth said, it's something that we found in our work. There's a link there. The index shows another kind of correlation between the two. And I think it's something that's really worth exploring, particularly in the context of trying to, you know, justify investment in heritage in the current climate.
Great. Gareth?
Well, the marine underwater, yes, we must talk about this. Come and get in touch with me and with Jonathan, who's the project lead within the RSA. There was a bit of Twitter stuff around this when the index came out, so maybe you're responsible for that, but let's talk about that.
So I think the answer is no, but we might do next time.
Well, not in that this time. On the what are we doing? So, okay, so there's a couple of commitments we've already made. One is to do it again. Secondly, I mean, I think you've got to remember that it's been incredibly successful at this, but this was meant to give some exposure and raise the profile of a longer research project, and we chose to do it during the course of that research project rather than saving it to the end. So we've got a while to go. There's some sort of more work going on which is beginning to address those sort of questions and about how we, RSA, whoever, can engage with these sort of new combined authorities as that begins to develop. You know, we're trying to get in a bit early on all of that. Then, but we have said that we'll think about it seriously in terms of our development activity, which is what we, the resource, extra resource we put in to get applications from particular places, which has really just been driven by sort of two things around deprivation, around low spending so far, low funding from us, but maybe we can add this in as a sort of a further layer. We need to do some thinking about it, give us a bit of space to do that. The other, we have said there are things in here which might prompt ideas and conversations about potential projects, so use it in that way. And I think, you know, in time we may be having some, it's maybe a sort of a facility we've got to have conversations with city regions and things. And the final thing I'd like to make, because we haven't talked about it very much, is my sort of another hope that I've got for that is to build a bit of connection between natural heritage and cities, and reconnecting cities with their rural hinterland, as I sort of like to think of it. And
that's a big picture. Leo, I'm afraid it genuinely is 30 seconds.
Okay, so I think that it was really interesting question about the sort of relationship between participation and assets, and you know, how that's going to be, sort of create some sort of instrumentality. I think it's also very interesting the question from here about you know, the role of gender in this, in terms of assets and participation as well. And going back to that original idea of heritage, it's you know, and create a better future. Actually, you know, that narrative is one that is going to be debatable for a very long time, but I think it's important to have that debate and to make that a very lively debate in terms of just places and also activity, because it's about creating on a local scale. And I think what the real debate is going to be very soon is going to be about devolution, about local heritage compared to national heritage.
Great. So I'm going to ask you in a moment to thank our wonderful panel. Of course, we can sometimes see heritage assets being created for nothing. The way the Labour Party has decided to turn itself into a museum for socialism, for example, is a great example of that. But just a few more things about our project. We've got question time sessions a bit like this taking place in, I think, Dundee, Bristol and Oldham. So if you are any of those places or you're listening to us online, you can go to the RSA website and find out about that. Someone asked about the RSA. I mean, of course, we venerate this house. We're about to develop it further, but we will always do what we always do, which is to celebrate the history of the building as well as making it a modern building which can be used by our fellows. More importantly, possibly, Joanna has been building a network of RSA fellows who are heritage champions, who are taking this work into their localities and using it as the basis for conversations. The next journal of the RSA is going to be dedicated to heritage and got some really, really interesting articles, a lot of them exploring this question between history and the modern nature of places. So it's been absolutely fantastic. I didn't know anything about heritage 2 years ago. I'm incredibly excited about it. Now I hope that some of our excitement has worn off on you, but please join me in thanking our fantastic panel, Maria, Leo, Anastasia and Gareth.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.